Good morning, everyone. The first case on calendar today is Dong versus Wilkerson, case number 56591. We have Christopher Westby for counsel for the appellant and Marsha Willock as counsel for the respondent. Are counsel prepared to proceed?
Yes.
Please do.
May it please the court. My name is Chris Rusby and I represent the appellant Craig Dong. And Ms. Clerk, may I please reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. The district court's post-judgment order dividing the party's property rights 6 years after the divorce decree was entered should be reversed for three reasons. The first reason, the prior divorce was final pursuant to NRCP 60 and there was no continuing jurisdiction. Number two, even if this jurisdictional deficiency was overlooked, the pension was fully disclosed, it was actually litigated, and Catherine Dong presented no equitable basis for the court to overcome the claim preclusion doctrine. And third, Catherine's claim for a time barred pursuant to the four-year residual statute.
Were both the parties represented by counsel at the time the divorce was entered?
At the time of the divorce, no, but 2 weeks prior, or actually 6 days prior, they were. Both counsel had moved to withdraw, and those motions were granted two judicial days before the divorce. I think Memorial Day was one of those days. But both the legislature and this court have recognized the strong policy interests inherent in the finality of judgments. This is not a case where an asset was undisclosed or unknown at the time of the divorce, nor is this a case where the asset was not a part of the divorce controversy itself. Rather, this is a case where a party agreed to a property distribution, enjoyed the benefits therefrom for 6 years, and then through her newly retained attorney, tried to take advantage of a technical defect in the actual written divorce decree. The evidence before the court was overwhelming and uncontroverted that this asset was actually disclosed, was actually litigated, and made a part of the initial alimony determination. Indeed, the court found, and I have from page 1536, volume 8 of the record appeal, this is the court's finding. I think, hands down, we've got a full disclosure for discussion of it. And the fact that everybody was on notice that there was a pension that was a part of, made a part of the initial alimony decision. And in this appeal, the respondents have not challenged this finding at all. There's been no finding of fraud. They concede that no fraud existed. And under these circumstances, every legal and equitable doctrine favors reversal in this case.
How do you distinguish the Amy versus Amy case, point one and point two? Is that still good law, or has it been called into question by subsequent general case law on independent actions in Rule 60?
I don't think it's been called into question. I think that it's distinguishable from the facts of this case, because in Amy, the asset, which was a judgment for back wages in a wrongful termination case, that the judgment occurred after the divorce decree. But there is no mention in the opinion whether the asset was known at the time of the divorce, whether they litigated. But the key fact was that the other side, both sides agreed that it just wasn't a part of the divorce controversy. And I think that that part is still good law. And I think that is one of the exceptions to claim preclusion would be in these type of cases. The first would be any of the grounds set forth in NRCP 60B, fraud, mistake, misconduct on the other's part, that through an independent action, you can proceed to try and set aside a judgment. It's a very demanding standard. I think this court has recognized that recently. And then the other exception that I think some of the cases stand for, Amy, the Williams versus Wildman case, maybe Nevada Bank versus Wolf, I think that there's some question whether that's good law anymore, but those cases I think generally stand for a proposition that if the parties didn't have a fair chance to litigate this issue the first time, then they shouldn't be foreclosed from doing so later.
Counsel, let me ask you about Williams versus Waldman. I might disclose I was on the representative, Mr. Waldman, so I was on the losing side of that appeal. But as I recall in that case, the court did conclude that you could partition undivided assets in a subsequent proceeding. Here, if I recall, I know we argued the statute of limitations. I don't think the court addressed it in its opinion in that case. But assuming you can divide, and that's why I hear from Mr. Bullock about the statute of limitations, the time element involved in this case. Do you have any further thoughts on that?
I do. In Williams versus Waldman, I think that the point that the court found why she could divide that property, besides the fact that she was unrepresented and he was an attorney, was that it was kept from her. She didn't know about the pension. So I think with respect to a statute of limitations, that if the parties knew about the asset at the time of the divorce or at some subsequent time, that and they had the right or the chance, the opportunity to litigate that asset, it was divisible, that the statute of limitations should run at that point. There has to be some time limitation. In this case, we've got something, a motion that was filed 6 years after the fact. If 6 years is okay, why isn't 16 years or 26 years okay? There has to be...
What is okay? What's the statute of limitations in this type of a situation?
Well, there's no statute of limitations directly on point, but the four-year residual statute of limitations, which is NRS 11.220, provides that all other actions not previously provided for are within the four-year, or barred if not brought within 4 years. And so if that doesn't apply to these cases, or to partition of assets, there has to be some other time limitation, latches, or something else that takes into account.
Why would there be a statute of limitations on a partition action? Suppose the case here had been a house. It's the omitted asset. I presume then that the parties would continue forward as tenants in common and would think that they could partition the home 30 years later.
I guess
it would be different than the retirement fund in this case.
Well, I think that there has to be a fact that if the other party is exclusively using the property and they knew about it, the other party knew about it, they had the chance, it was divisible at the time, that there has to be some limitation. And if one party is living in the house and the other is completely excluded, if they don't bring their claim within a certain amount of time, I think that it would be barred under the four-year residual. And the same with the pension. One of the facts in this case is that he was receiving all the pension because it was in his name. It came from his employer. And that there has to be some time limitation on when we can bring an action.
Justice Hardesty touched upon the issue of an omitted asset. Is this truly an omitted asset in light of what we have? It was not in the divorce decree, but it seems, based upon the record and even going into the settlement where the parties were told to leave each other's retirement alone by a judge, that the parties were aware of it. So is this a omitted retirement? Is it actually omitted from your standpoint?
No, it's not omitted. It might be omitted from the divorce decree, but it was not omitted from the divorce controversy. And I think that is the key fact for claim preclusion purposes, is if an asset wasn't disclosed, if it was unknown, if there wasn't a fair opportunity, if somebody fraudulently precluded the other from knowing, then it can be considered an omitted asset. But in this case, no, it wasn't. Everybody knew about it. The court made these specific findings.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
That's a pretty simple analysis, and it sounds good and precise. But my question is, what did the thing that Judge Boulay do that you take issue with, this precise legal issue upon which you believe there is error?
Right. The court made the finding that there was full disclosure and that it was actually a part of the alimony decision that was litigated. But despite those facts, she still partitioned the asset and what we contend is a faulty reading of Amy, where Amy, and I think the respondent was taking the position that if there is an omitted asset, that the only fact that matters is if it wasn't included in the divorce decree. Whether or not it was actually litigated, that the only operative fact is if it was or was not in the divorce decree itself.
Which would require us to take a rather technical reading of Amy, at least to apply it to your facts. Would you agree with that?
I would agree completely. And in that case, form will always prevail over substance. The reasons why it was omitted should be considered. I think the case law is pretty clear that in order to later divide an asset through an equitable action or through a motion, which we contend has to be filed within 6 months, but if it was through an independent action, it's a demanding standard. It has to be a grave miscarriage of justice, and so the reasons why are important.
She didn't have a lawyer at the time when this was resolved completely. It was 2 weeks before that the lawyer withdrew, right?
Correct.
Should we give some type of information to that if we write an opinion in this manner? But she did not have a lawyer, and that maybe she assumed, and who wrote the decree? I'm assuming the other attorney wrote the decree. I don't think the judge wrote the decree.
No. No, Your Honor, both parties weren't represented by counsel at the time. The decree was prepared by Mr. Darren, my client, at the court's discretion, and it was the date of the divorce. The hearing was May 27th, and the divorce decree was later entered August 8th of 2003, so there was a period of lapse there, but to answer your question more directly, no, I don't think that the fact that she was not represented, and nor was my client, they held to the same standards.
Since Mr. Dome did the decree, did anybody ever ask him under oath why he omitted the pension?
No, and that's one of the problems, that there was no full evidentiary hearing in this case. My client presented some testimony when he was representing himself, but Catherine Dome never testified, as she's never subject to cross-examination. Why the property was omitted from the divorce decree was never even brought up by the moving party. They never said why it wasn't there. They never controverted my client's testimony that it was all discussed during the off-the-record settlement conference, that it was made a part of the divorce, that the alimony decision was based on it. She received the entirety of the house, which she refinanced it a year later and received almost $60,000 out of that refinance. And the record on appeal establishes that the alimony decision, I think it was almost $1,200 she got per month, that amount was determined based on the fact that she would get the entire house and not the pension.
If this were to go back for some reason, does that mean there would have to be a new consideration of offsets?
I agree, Your Honor. There would have to be you can't rescind a part of an agreement. If the rest of the agreement is all intertwined and based on that, you'd have to rescind the entire thing, and you'd have to go back and litigate these issues. Craig would be entitled to an offset for his half equity in the house, as well as the increased alimony payments that he paid for 7 years based on the fact that he would be keeping his pension.
So the rule in Nevada would be that in every divorce case where somebody omitted something, a pension in one case, a gold coin in another case, we're going to re-litigate the divorce cases till the cows come home.
No, I don't think that should be the position at all.
But that's the result.
That would be the result if the court affirmed if
the court upholds Judge Ross in this case, that's the result.
That would be the result, yes, Your Honor.
We have a minute left.
Yes.
I'll add 2 minutes to that so that you have 3 minutes and some of your seconds in the bottom. And I'll add 2 minutes to Mr. Willett's time.
Thank you.
Mr. Willock, as you approach, I'd like you to at least start with the question that I posited to the petitioner in this case. I suggested that he would present in a very precise manner of, that's the path to reversal, frankly. And so my question is, I guess, a little bit different to them. Why in the world, after all this time, do we want to redo this, number one, several years passing from the original divorce? But most importantly, I think, along with a couple of my colleagues here, worried about using a standard that talks about an omitted asset or a hidden asset. And I guess I'd like to know if your position is such that if we talk about it in settlement, but we don't put it in the divorce decree, is it always fair game? And my point is, therefore, with this agreement, should it have been in the divorce decree that, oh, by the way, each party will retain their own retirements, you agree that in exchange for that, blah, blah, blah. I mean, I'm a little bit concerned about how far we might be stretching Amy.
I don't believe it's a stretch to answer the Justice Douglas's question. That quote comes only from Craig Dunn. The judge denied that any such statement was ever made, that any such conversation was ever had, that any negotiation ever occurred, any consideration was ever given to the pension. There is a difference between the assets we're talking about here. The first pension and the TSP account were confused by both lawyers, arguing the matters below and by the judge throughout.
Well, look, as to that issue, though, there's some discussion in the record that information as to her pension and also information as to his pension because of payments he was were being deducted from his salary were part of the record in terms of financial disclosure.
And
full recommendation.
Yes. When we get to that, Craig Dunn's paycheck reflects deductions for a TSP account. But his paycheck, like your paychecks, doesn't say anything about accrued service credits, which are the basis for the first pension that's at issue in this appeal.
But did it talk in terms of retirement?
A different account, a different plan, a different asset.
Not on the paycheck, on his stub.
The paycheck.
Because most stubs indicate something is deducted for retirement. But it doesn't tell you what it is. It just says, we're taking this out.
No. And that was divided. The TSP was expressly talked about. The reason we would supply the response appendix is to give you the page of the minutes which talked about what assets were actually considered.
What is discussed at record 1511? It's my understanding that Catherine admitted that Craig disclosed his FAA retirement benefits.
What's being copied in 11? I don't have that page sitting in front of me, but if that is what I think it is, that's the confusion I'm talking about. They're talking about the TSP and the 401k, and if you read the minutes from the disposition of the trial, they weighed the two against each other, and the trivial house equity.
How do we know this without an evidentiary hearing? I don't understand how the judge got from the decision that she made, where she said everything was disclosed, and now a motion for reconsideration, without much analysis, and citing Amy and your article, she says, nope, we're going to reverse this.
If you look at the long string cite to pages of the record that are in the answering brief, you'll see that she closely looked through her record of conversation and discovered that the only things that she was dealing with was the TSP. The two AFCs that he talks about having been exchanged would only list TSP.
Did the judge become a witness as a consequence, and should there have been an action?
I don't believe that there was, that the judge became a witness. The judge became a reviewer of her own trial record. This goes to the court's second question as to the independent action motion question. The reason it's perfectly appropriate for these cases to return to the court which heard the case in the first place is that that court is uniquely situated to be able to answer the question that you asked, whether or not it really was disclosed in consideration, an offset, etc.
That argument can be made in any civil case in which 60B applies. So why doesn't 60B apply in family law cases and those standards?
The rule is different in family law because it is a unique situation. The parties have a fiduciary duty of disclosure, and the Nevada legislature and this court have made a policy statement as to what the policy is.
What action do you rely on when you say this court has made that policy statement? I'm really concerned with carving out a separate, endlessly litigable arena in our law.
Family law is inherently different. The current state of the law is as stated in Waldman. An asset left unadjudicated and not disposed of in the decree is subject to partition, the parties being tenants in common until that time.
But Walden was a case of overreaching, and one side was a lawyer and the other was unrepresented. Is that not correct?
There's no less overreaching just because one of the credentials of one of the parties is different. Mr. Walden here did exactly what Mr. Walden did, exactly the same way.
Do you think that this case is controlled by Bunnell versus Lawrence or NCDSH, where we quite clearly adopted Begley and its limitations on independent actions to set aside judgments?
No.
Why not?
Family law is inherently different. For the same reason that the other eight community property states have unanimously said that family law cases are inherently different. The parties co-own the assets in question, not at the time of the divorce decree and not pursuant to some other commercial matter, but at the moment of acquisition. Catherine Dunn's interest in the retirement benefits in question did not accrue in 2003 when this decree was entered. They accrued in 1985 when those benefits were earned, and 1986, and 1987. Nothing that happened in 2003 upset that interest. And to answer the question that I believe Justice Hardesty asked, this is exactly the same as a partition action for real estate under Nevada law. There is no statute of limitations applicable when the parties already co-own the asset in question.
So your position is there's no threshold showing required. If it is not literally mentioned in the written divorce decree, somebody can always come back in and reopen this?
That's not what I'm saying.
Okay, what are you saying?
That's
what's
the evidence of whether it was expressly considered. But it goes to the issue of the house, which Justice Sayre asked. If it was part and parcel of the distribution of assets, really, and the trial court judge is the proper person to make that determination, then it's already been litigated. That's within the field of litigation. What this, within the field of litigation is a term this court made up in Amy, and you defined it in Amy as included by the parties within their agreement and then in the resulting decree. That's the definition of included within the field of litigation. If it was actually litigated, discussed, then you have a 60A clerical remission from a decree, which is a no-brainer. That's not difficult. But if it wasn't ever disclosed, if it wasn't ever considered, if it wasn't actually weighed, then it's an omitted asset. The parties still co-own it. And nothing happens upon the entry of a divorce decree, which separates their ownership interests from the innocent.
Mr. Wood, you said that your client knew about this from as long ago, or this accrued to her benefit as long ago as the early 80s. How is this omitted then?
The ownership interest accrued in the 80s when they were earned during the marriage. Since 1891, Nevada has defined marital property as property that accrues during the marriage. But that doesn't mean she had a clue about it, and it doesn't mean she wasn't cheated out of it upon divorce.
So then the second part of my question is, I think that you didn't answer from my first question, and that is, why did we take so long to get where we are? And isn't that a problem? Even if we recognize family law is inherently different than other areas of law, don't we have a problem with her for her to become aware of this?
This court has approved the Casas holding, the Hen holding three times, and Hen dealt with each one of those issues, both in statutes of limitations and collateral estoppel, and the question of whether it's a matter of law or equity. And what the California Supreme Court said in Hen is that there is no statute of limitations to claim their own property. It doesn't make sense. It's a non sequitur. The parties co-own the property from the moment of its acquisition, and nothing occurs in a divorce that is silent as to that issue to divest anybody of their interest. Nor should it, because that simply encourages fraud by omission. As far back as 1989, this court's gender bias task force reported that spouses were routinely being divested of their interests and assets by silent omission from decrees of divorce, and recommended doing something about it. In 1993, the legislature acted by enacting a statute requiring the actual equal distribution of all marital property. States with similar statutes have held that the court's jurisdiction to perform its legislative mandate is not exhausted until it actually does what the statute says the court must do, which is actually equally distribute the property between the two parties. Until that time, it's not a matter of waiting a long time. It's a matter of an error correctable at any time.
Mr. Litigation, in terms of what you're stating right now, does that mean that if this was remanded back, that the family law court would have to go ahead and look at any asset that was omitted on both sides, both parties.
Anybody can make a claim that an answer was omitted in the reply brief, unfortunately. Craig brings up an allegation that the house was omitted. But if you look at the minutes, the house was not omitted. He had put a value on it of $14,000. By the time the judge got done with the offsets and the other pots and pans, he was given a credit of $800.
Well, Mr. Willick, I want to be real careful with what we do with this case, considering in Clark County that over 60% of the people are in proper person. And that's why I'm real concerned as far as my colleagues who are involved in access to justice, Justice Hardesty and Justice Douglas, that we make sure that what can we do to remedy this situation besides just affirming this finding by Judge Moss? So we have to say some things that people understand. Otherwise, we open the door for everybody to go back. When I got divorced, everything I had was community property, of course, because I was a student, and when I got married, and everything was community property. So, according to you, if I admitted something, even purposely, that certainly it could be brought back up.
Why doesn't make any difference?
Accidentally, I should say, but not purposely.
Well, that's the point. It doesn't make any difference why, and it shouldn't make any difference why. The matter of unjust enrichment is the result, not the cause. The allegation in the reply brief that you should only allow partition in cases of mutual mistake but not in deliberate fraud is exactly backwards. That makes no sense.
Mr. Wood, what about Justice Paradise's question, I think, to opposing counsel? If we agree that it was an open door to reestablishing what's an equitable distribution between the parties and whether or not the value of this asset was in fact considered at the time of the original divorce.
Anybody's just going to claim. But if Craig brought a motion saying that I omitted from the decree of divorce that I wrote this house value, the court would simply look at the minutes, say, no, well, you're entitled to a 60A amendment to the decree you wrote saying that the house was actually considered and distributed to her. That's all, again, that's the reason you never did it. Because it was actually litigated. It was actually distributed. It was actually...
I think what Justice Gibbons and Justice Panagiri's question raises an important remedy question here. The assumption is that the omitted asset should simply be partitioned at some point in the future without being subjected to a statute of limitations defense. But counsel's argument is that in this case and in many cases, the division of assets was the product of negotiation and a settlement. Why isn't the remedy a reopening of the settlement?
There is no need to reopen. It's simply a matter of partition.
There might not be a need to, but that's a different question than whether that's the appropriate remedy.
Eight other community property states have approached this question, and they have unanimously decided that the remedy partition is the appropriate way of dealing with questions of omission of assets from divorce decrees. It is the uniform law in the community property system. This state is the only state with any variation from that uniform practice. And the Hen case from California, which this court has said that it's adopting, weighs the matter as the right to your own property as a matter of law, and all defenses as a matter of equitable defenses, latches, equitable estoppel. You can bring them all up and answer Justice Sotomayor's question. If there was a secondary omission on the other side, then it'll come up in the same proceeding. But it doesn't make any sense to say that you're opening the floodgates or anything else. The question is whether... I'm sorry.
No, go ahead and finish your thought.
The question is whether the assets were actually distributed. The statutory mandate, it's not discretionary. It is mandatory. The court shall equally distribute the marital property. And the court's jurisdiction to do so is not exhausted until that property is actually distributed.
I guess I'm getting stuck here. I'm looking at Judge Moss's March 11th order. She so specifically went through and indicated this was not an omitted asset.
Okay, Tony?
Described the FAA retirement very specifically, and then turned around just a little bit later and says, oh, never mind.
The question is what she was talking about. She was handed in discovery a stack of sheets of paper that are in the record that say, gee, there's a retirement. And what they're talking about is what's on his affidavit of financial conditions. It's the TSP. It took the judge, it was 2 years, to figure out that there were two different assets. When we get to the partition clause...
She specifically referenced the FAA...
It is the FAA retirement.
But there were several...
There's several different ones.
Correct.
The first pension is the $1 million admitted asset.
And in her motion to reconsider and her findings there, I mean, her factual findings in the first order, the March order, are very specific. And they're actually consistent with the concept that there was a settlement here. And so it's not inconsistent. I don't see the first order as being inconsistent with the...
It's not inconsistent if you know what she was talking about. And all she was talking about was the property was actually disclosed. The TSP is on the face of the affidavit of financial condition and given a value of $20,000. That came up during the settlement negotiations. It's on the face of the minutes. The $1 million pension never came up because it would be impossible in the facts of this case or virtually any other case for there to be enough property to ever outweigh the primary motor asset. Craig Bowen has already put in his pocket nearly $500,000 in payments. He's been getting her 30% of the pension each and every month, and it's not a windfall. It is not an extra proceeding to be given your own property. That's her property. He's putting it in his pocket every month.
So, if Mrs. Dunn passes away, and this property that you're talking about is still in debate here, does the cause of action go to her children?
Yes. You answered that question with. And the... Her share of the property passes to heirs.
So then we have clearly created no finality in family.
Oh, no, there's finality. All you have to do is actually do what the statutory mandate requires. Actually, equally divide the marital estate between the parties. This woman spent 20 years trying to encourage the full disclosure and actual division of property. You have passed rules, including 16-2, saying that the entirety of an asset, if you fail to bring it before the court, could be handed over to the other side. You spent more time than you can probably stand in all forms intended to accomplish that same result. It makes no sense to resurrect case law from an earlier era under an earlier statute which causes, encourages, invites the opposite behavior. Telling people that if all they have to do is quietly leave it out, and if they can get possession of it, they get to keep it. That's the rule of departments and it needs to go. It makes no sense for that earlier case law to be resurrected at this time. The rule of Amy, Vermont's, Cook, Waldman is the correct view, the only reasonable view, and the only equitable view. Catherine Doan died utterly destitute, penniless, and unsupported because she wasn't getting the portion of the property that she needed to live. That shouldn't be allowed to happen again.
Go ahead.
I see that my time is up, and I'd be pleased to answer any further questions that the court might have. I think the court has time.
That my opposing counsel made that the retirement, the pension was not disclosed is flatly wrong from the record.
I think what he was saying is it was confused.
Well, the record only supports that the only person who was confused about it was Catherine's attorney at the time of filing the motion. The court wasn't, Craig wasn't, even Catherine wasn't, and she never disputed it.
Counsel, Mr. Willett talked in terms of the policy of the state and the policy of the state to equally divide the assets. How do you respond?
Well, they did, Your Honor, in this case. That it can only be reasonably assumed that they did if Catherine received the entirety of the marital residence and, according to the record, increased alimony. How can they say that it wasn't, that it was equally divided when Catherine received the entirety of the marital residence, which at the time, in 2003, in Las Vegas, real property is clearly the most valuable asset of the marriage. She refinanced in this, and this is contained at page... Volume 5 on the record. record appeal pages 912 through 914. And you see that she refinanced, paid off all of her community debts, everything, none of that money.
We have a settlement agreement that just wasn't memorialized by the parties that outlines this? Are you asking us to assume that's the case?
The evidence in the record establishes that that is the case. And I don't mean to belabor the point, but none of this evidence was ever controverted. If it were the case that this was never discussed, isn't it reasonable to assume that during one of the three hearings, that Catherine or her attorney would submit an affidavit, or they would say, no, Your Honor, that's not the case?
It's not a question of controverted. The question is, where is it asserted?
To establish that?
Well, Your Honor, Craig testified during the first hearing, and I'm looking for the citation to that, and what he said was that during the off-the-record settlement conference, all my retirement pension was discussed, that it was made part of the deal. And that is the only testimony in all of the hearings.
Could you comment briefly on your opponent's argument that federal law's difference, so the ordinary rules governing finality of judgments should not apply in this arena?
Yes, Your Honor. Well, that's contrary to NRS 125.090 that says that the civil rules of civil procedure apply to family law cases. If that's the case and they don't, then there's an obvious conflict with the statutory scheme. Finality of judgment should apply even more in divorce cases. You have two parties who have lived together, been very intimate, and now they are at an irreconcilable difference. To keep those parties together and to keep litigating, I believe that the finalities are even more important in cases like that.
Thank you very much.
Thank
both sides for their excellent arguments on their briefs, and I appreciate your undertaking this representation.
Thank you.